Thanos.
All right, everybody. Hello.
Hello.
If you were not here yesterday, my identity is the same as it was yesterday. I'm Jeff Kersengrip. I'm a PhD in communication. I've been at the University of Portland for 25 years and teaching college for nearly 40, which seems odd. I must have started when I was 10 because I look so young. I really started when I was 12. So today, I wanted to start by revisiting what we finished with last time in case any of you came up with thoughts about what sorts of dilemmas we might be able to tie to communicating science. I thought of another one that I've added to the list. I thought we might edit that list for a couple minutes before we start. But the very first thing I'd like you to do is please just turn to the people around you and greet them. Give them your name if you like doing that. If you don't like giving your name, just say hello. All right, but be nice.
Okay.
So, as we did some of yesterday, we'll do a lot more of today. There's some information to share with you, but also lots of chances for you to chat with each other and to do some thinking. Today's session is the second in a series of four. They're all standalone. They're fine if you'll understand each one if you just see one or two. But they do kind of accumulate over time. Yesterday we talked about what is communicating science? Well, how do we understand it? And what are some dilemmas related to it? Where could we go with it? Today we're thinking about what are the things we know about us as humans, as both the people who created the scientific system, right? And also purvey it and respond to it. So what are some things we know from science about humans? So that's our focus today. And we'll finish today with probably about a 15, 20 minute sort of reflective case study. Today's really a nicely reflective day. Thinking about ourselves, we are all, I assume, humans, or else really, really clever AI disguised in robotic bodies. So I'm going to assume we're all dealing with, these are forces that apply to all of us. So it'll be interesting if we're looking at the Jubilee call to reflect, among other things. Today is really a nice day for reflection. So we'll finish today with a 20-minute sort of chance to test these forces' impacts in your own life relative to any particular issue. But let's start here. This is where we finished yesterday. And if you weren't here yesterday, we talked a lot about what science communication was about and then finished by saying, so what dilemmas in the world feel like they have something, that communicating science has something to do with how successfully we're going to deal with those dilemmas? The one I thought about after attending Jim's session yesterday, Jim Bolter, was the UN Sustainability Project is talking about good governance actually as essential to sustainability on the planet. So, tying it to planetary sustainability, there's something about a good government, and because we're in the U.S., we're still a democracy, so I called it good democratic governance. I'm wondering if any of the rest of you had things that I could stenograph for you into the document and save for later. Are there other dilemmas that occurred to you like, oh, that has something to do with communicating science? You're nodding. Do you want to speak words, or are you just agreeing with me?
I'm a psychologist. I nod a lot. Sorry.
Yay! You're welcome to nod. Please don't stop. I just didn't want to miss a chance to sort of let you speak if you wanted to.
Thank you.
My name is Jeff, by the way. Jeff Kersengrip. Jeff KG. My students know my last name. The easiest way to pronounce my name is Jeff. But, students really have a hard time with that sometimes. So there are three comparisons that help people for Kersengrip. I was born Kersen. I got the grip from Emily 30 years ago. So we're both Kersengrip. But to think of it as a plumbing tool, that really helps people. Like, hand me that cursing grip, that's really nice. Or a wrestling hold, that works sometimes. Oh no, the cursing grip. Or my all-time favorite was one student one time said it reminded him of a medieval disease. And I thought, that's fantastic. Remember my name? It's a medieval disease. Am I typing? Look, I'm poised.
Do you want more specifics for conflicting worldviews? Or is that whatever. Supposed to be like the stew pot for evolution? And
well, what do you think?
I don't know.
Well, you might as well add climate change and evolution.
I would add to the evolution, we had the Bible class this morning about if the creation story is a fact, then why are there kind of two creation stories in the Bible? And why would people, if they're literally reading the Bible, where's the contradiction there?
How do you see communicating science playing into that?
Well, I think that's the evolution comment about what does science tell us about natural history versus if the Bible had a more coherent narrative, that might be a little more of an argument about it.
Nice. I'm going to add a second piece here that I think is related, Jeff, that not just how it's created, but then how are we supposed to then be stewards?
I think there's Lars.
I'm Jeff.
I think there still is a dilemma with exploring outer space, the resources that we put into outer space versus the dilemma of dealing with our own planet. Mm-hmm. And those kind of discussions have been going on ever since before mm-hmm. we went to the moon.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Mars actually today. It's in my plan, not for long. Go ahead, I see a hand in the window. Yeah. Is that Jeffrey?
I was thinking about like just kind of the lack of interest about science from some people, because okay. obviously there are going to be a lot of people out there who, you know, they're not science buffs, they don't really care too much about science, so mm-hmm. it could be a little bit of a dilemma trying to, you know, mm-hmm. emphasize the importance of it to them when they mm-hmm. don't necessarily want it shoved in their face.
Right. That's nice. That's like a meta dilemma. Dilemma about dilemmas. Go ahead, Bob.
If you're really talking about communicating science, you need to have facts and data at your hands. Mm-hmm. Knowing a broad set of facts and data is challenging. Whereas folks that are presenting misinformation, all they have to do is make it up.
Yep. In the absence of some kind of standard or experience to vet against what you're noticing, you're really kind of stuck. We'll talk about this today, actually, too. It is part of what goes on. Carol, go ahead.
I wonder, I wish I could think of the person and the book name. It was about differences in values that people have. And the one that's coming to mind is respect for authority.
Oh.
And there are differences across humanity in how much of that you have inside you.
Okay.
And when we're dealing with differences in people and how they value that.
Okay. How do you see communicating science playing in?
I see it as...
I see you.
As a person who has... I am not this person. A high respect for authority.
Mm-hmm.
If yeah. you present
you got
some,
that right.
this would be my husband speaking.
Yes, of course. Thank you.
But a person who does have a high respect for authority has authority figures, and if what you're saying contradicts them, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter how well the argument is put out.
Great. So kind of the argument side of science, thinking about part of scientific method is we're drawing logical propositions, deductions and inductions from data yeah. and logic, right? Beautiful. Go ahead. One more then.
Kind of going along with what with the planetary the planetary class yesterday, developmental sustainability and kind of how big companies and leaders in our economy and mm-hmm. these extremely high-ranking, high-knowing, like everybody knows all these companies, and these companies are not communicating the same thing that scientists are mm-hmm. sometimes, and so that, like, they're not...
Right.
Yeah.
And Jim yesterday talked about greenwashing, right, as a way of sounding like you're doing that work when you're not really. You just want to be in that conversation and get credit for it. Person in yellow. I wish I knew all your names. I just don't.
Sonia.
Thank you, Sonia.
Hi. I think just in general, understanding about communicable disease in general, like because we are in this pandemic, we're going to be in more of them,
mm-hmm.
and how communicable disease is also related to climate change. I mean, the connections between those and poverty as well. I mean, they're so interrelated, but understanding basics about virus and vector and context and all that kind of thing, people struggle to understand communicable disease.
You are correct. You're watching me struggle with PowerPoint. You see me choosing 18 font, right?
Yep. Yeah. Well, you have to expand the slide.
Yeah, it doesn't have
the problem is that there's a lot of
that bottom handle down.
Who's the expert here?
Not me. All right, I'll do it later.
We need to pull that bottom down. And then
pull the bottom down?
The bottom.
That's the top. See the little dot in the middle
that
of the bottom?
Pull that down.
Okay, and then that's going to let me, it just does it automatically.
It does it for you.
So when you be able to see it?
You can pull the top up also.
Yeah.
Woo! 20th century technology, I am mastering, but that then pulls our words above the waterline. I'm going to keep it. Oh, there are. All right. Trust me, I will fix this later. So thank you for this start. This is where we're headed, is thinking about, you know, this is consequential stuff we're dealing with. We don't communicate science very well. And remember, communication is both the process of exhaling, right, but also how we inhale. Communication people are just as interested in how we take in what we get from other people. The conversational equivalent is when somebody is quiet with you. They haven't stopped communicating. In fact, sometimes that's the most eloquent thing you can say. Think of the last time you were with somebody who was grieving, and the best thing to say was not, right? Was just to sort of be there. So we're sensitive to all those pieces, and that's where we're headed today, is thinking about how this all works. Let me get into today's piece. And let's start with a couple of artifacts. This was kind of fun. Anybody run across this movement? Do you know about this one?
Yeah.
It was meant as satire, right? This young man said, held up a sign, and all the deep state had replaced all the birds with drones. It's been a very interesting story to follow. Let's see if it'll go there. That's not a very hopeful sound. Okay, never mind. Oh, that's a problem, actually. Can't locate the server or proxy server. Okay, well, that's going to be a problem later. So, anyway, boy, technology today is just starting us off in a great space. I like this one only because it shows this really nice line, really clear line, that's getting kind of blurry between reality and satire, that they started a satirical movement as a way to make fun of conspiracy theory, theorizing, and it got embraced as a conspiracy theory and has been continuing. So, you know, he's a little perplexed by it. It's an interesting story. It's a real recent story from The Guardian. So if you're interested, you can just Google it and read sort of a synopsis of what's been going on with this story. But that's the realm we're dealing with today, is which forces affect how we engage with scientific realities. What do we know from scientific research about the things that actually kind of buffet us about? What are the things that offer us headwinds? You know, if I'm thinking about, I want to really understand this science that's coming in, I want to understand all things that are found in a defensible way, and I want to incorporate them into my life, and there are all these things that make that harder. So today is a way to look at all that machinery and then to try it out on ourselves here. So why are we such skewed processors? Right, and resistant knowers often of scientifically discovered realities, especially things that are inconvenient for us. I like that Al Gore's long ago documentary, when we still called it what it is, global warming, climate change, actually was a win for the political right, by the way. It was a way to make us not focus on global warming. There was a fight over what to call it, and climate change won. But I thought he was right back in the day to use the phrase an inconvenient. What was the name of this film?
True.
That's a really nice metaphor for what we're focusing on today. Those are the places where we're especially challenged. Why do we resist? And we're skewed processors because we're not wired to be objective, right? We're wired to survive. So the things that we pick up on in an environment are the things that feed most basely into the stuff we need to survive in an environment. So we're already, just as humans, kind of wired for fight or flight, you know, self-protection, preservation, propagation. And that those things don't set us up for this kind of work in the system. So we often have trouble incorporating new facts. We conflate them with opinions. We conflate them with value judgments. The owner of Fox News, for example, Rupert Murdoch, famously said that he wants all news to become a matter of opinion in people's eyes. Fox News is licensed as an entertainment channel. It's not a news channel. News is in their title. And they co-opt, you know, the way news broadcasts look, right? They've got the flaggy stuff behind, and they have anchors at desks and things like that. They borrow those schemes and tropes to say this looks like news. But that underneath it all, you know, we've got opinion leaders really trying to get us to conflate facts with opinions, which is one of the headwinds we'll talk about a little bit. But let's first go to satire, which is a really nice place to go when you want to understand how this stuff works. We're going to look at this little, it's a 3-minute video. It's got a couple of swears in it, sorry. But it's really a great illustration of this. Let me see if I can make it work. Here you go. 3 minutes, 33 seconds.
Man, there were so many incredible super diverse movies last year.
Diverse movies?
Yeah, like Moonlight or Lion, Hidden Figures and Fences, movies that didn't like just feature white people.
So interesting. I never really thought about that.
really? Even after the whole Oscars so white thing and all the articles written about it?
Call me crazy, but I just don't see race. I guess I'm just the least right
here. Okay.
Race is like often like a pretty obvious thing to observe. It's not like racist to notice.
I had to laugh. Zach, my goodness, I only see one race.
Ugh.
The human race.
Such bullshit. You're only telling yourself that so you don't have to think about racism or confront your own prejudices.
No, I'm not prejudiced, okay? I don't even judge Trap for being a woman.
I'm a man, Katie, you know that.
No, honestly, I just guessed. This is gonna sound weird, but I don't see gender and I don't see sex. I just see people.
You don't see how men and women look different?
No, I just see, like, shapeless blobs.
Okay, and if one of those shapeless blobs were pregnant, you would then know that it was a woman.
To me, it could just be, like, a heavy-set man who has, like, a big watermelon stomach. Mm. Okay? I just am so committed to equality. I'm just a good person.
Unless you're blind, you can tell that people have inherent differences.
Oh, I wouldn't know if I was blind or not because I don't see disabilities. I'm not a monster.
So, yeah. If someone were in a wheelchair, you wouldn't be able to see the wheelchair.
I have never seen a wheelchair.
Never seen a wheelchair.
I don't know what a wheelchair looks
if
like.
If someone were in a wheelchair, you would not install a ramp in your building.
I would refuse.
What if someone was missing a limb?
It's perhaps tucked under their little butt.
If someone were deaf.
Talk to them as if they could hear.
Why are you so proud of yourself?
Okay, well, here's a thought. Maybe you don't get it because you have less experience on Earth than I do.
Experience? We're all older than you.
I'm sorry, but I don't see age.
Oh, come on. You're telling me if there was an old woman and a baby, you wouldn't be able to tell which one's older? One of them is called an old woman. It's in the name, Katie.
Because I believe in equality, and I believe everyone is the same age.
That's not what equality means.
You have two older brothers. Can you at least acknowledge that?
Yes, and I believe both women are my same age.
Oh my god. What about your parents? How old were they when they had you?
I think they are both ageless and every age at the same time.
Jesus Christ, Katie. What else can you see?
Pretty much everything. Baldness, for example.
So Bruce Willis.
Is he bald?
He's famously bald.
I have no idea.
Katie, why are you doing this?
Guys, come on, okay? I just want to be able to do and say whatever I want, whenever I want, and I don't want to have to think about the world's problems.
Wow. What happened to the feed all of a sudden?
Yeah. It's buffering.
So the rest of the guys say, yeah, sounds pretty good. We better stop it so it doesn't start up halfway through something else here. So we're thinking about just dealing with facts, right? What do we do when we're dealing with facts? Our response often is a kind of resistance to them. That's sort of our default setting. It's a really seductive space to be in to say, I don't want to have to think about this stuff. Please don't make me think about this stuff. It's hard, because once you think it, you can't unthink it. You can't unsee it. And a lot of people just are uncomfortable being in that space. It does change you. You know, I teach a couple classes at the University of Portland where and I tell students in the first week, really, that if you stay, you're not going to see the world the same way. And I'm not bragging. I'm just saying that's the nature of this material. You know, so you are making a commitment when you're agreeing to take on new knowledge. And I'm speaking as a white guy, a pretty centered person, right? So there's lots of stuff that is comfortable about my life. My path is laid out for me by others. I have a really easy time relative to other folks in society. So it's much more difficult for folks who live in more marginalized spaces. They're a lot more eager to see those truths acknowledged. So let's try something here. I'd like to do one other little bit of video with you. This one's silent, and again, it's a report of historical information. And what I'd like you to do is, if you'd like to write or speak or whatever, it's just a couple minutes. I'd like us to watch it, and I'd like you to speak one-word responses to it, or just to note them to yourself, whatever you like. I'll ask you afterwards how you responded to this information here. Again, this is it's just a representation of factual information. We will get rid of these nice folks. Don't see race. Here we go. So this is what the Atlantic slave trade looked like. Here's 2 minutes worth.
This is amazing.
So remember, you may have descendants of some of the people who are represented by these dots in this room. And all it is, each of those ships is full of enslaved people. You said hello to some people near you. Would you mind just turning to those people for a minute and say some of the words that came to mind as you're watching that to them and listen to what they have to say to you? How did that, what do you think of those facts? As was true yesterday, remember that these are conversations that are going to start in this room. There'll be a lot of conversations to continue, and feel free with these people, other people, animals. And I'd love to hear, let's take about 3 minutes hearing some of your responses to the film. Can I start in this quadrant of the room? Any of the words that you ended up talking about with the people near you? Just speak them out.
Widespread.
Mm-hmm. Shocking.
Mm-hmm. Surprise.
Volume.
Volume, surprise, widespread, shocking.
Ignorance.
Ignorance.
Death.
Death.
For the ones that went to the Sugar Islands, mm-hmm. They didn't live long.
Right, yeah. So many ships coming. It's like they must have needed that many. How about here in the middle?
Depopulation.
Mm-hmm.
Generations.
Yeah. Right. Over here?
Hemorrhage.
Oh, great metaphor.
Bleeding.
Bleeding, yeah.
Going along with that.
Any others?
Wealth.
Wealth? Yeah.
Profit.
Not with the PH, right? But with the F?
Yeah.
Upstairs?
Recent.
Recent, yeah, that's the surprising thing.
Incomplete.
Yeah, incomplete. So I'm showing you this. It's a little emotionally weighty to do, and it's also necessary, but it's a reminder that even science, what we're doing, is science was invented by humans, and was invented to try and create some rigor in our sense-making, to leave out the stuff that should not be accepted as true in the world. And for communication, science gave us a common language to use to talk to each other about things we think we know in the world. But that it's done for and by and often about fallible human beings. We're far from politically objective purveyors, right, and consumers of scientific products. So that's really where we're headed right now, is to think about, so what do we understand about how the world works in terms of these forces? We're going to start kind of internally and move outward. This is the one force that I think a lot of us sort of assume is the main thing that's happening, and it is a big thing that's happening. What I want to invite you to do is, as I talk about each of these eight, we're going to go through them relatively quickly, but if you've got a direct experience of yourself noticing this force operating on you and you want to share that with us, let me know so we can get those stories in here. I'd like those stories to be stories about you, okay? So if you've got a story, make sure it's one that where you're applying this to yourself. So one of the things we know from scientific research about how people communicate science is that we've got a lot of cognitive biases as humans, and that those things can spur really interesting phenomena. I'll name a couple of them for you here, and I'll show you a chart that's got a lot more on them. But one is this. Have you heard of the backfire effect, anybody?
Yeah.
Where you get called out on something that you believe, and you're called out with factual information, and instead of being persuaded by that, you double down on your incorrect claim. So there's some more recent evidence that the backfire effect isn't as strong as we thought it was, and that it is actually surmountable, which is a nice thing. But that's one of the psychological pieces that's present. Another one is cognitive dissonance. We hate it when things don't line up in our heads. You ever introduce one of your good friends to another one of your good friends and they hate each other? And you have to come up with some way of making that okay in your head, like, oh, maybe it's this, right? We're just kind of driven to restore that balance. And so in the pandemic, this was an interesting study about the pandemic that this Atlantic article was reporting on, was once I make any kind of decision that I think is serious or I don't think it's serious, we begin to justify the wisdom of our choice and we find reasons to dismiss the alternative. We get invested in our own choices, and it's a lot harder than to walk away from them, especially once we've committed to them in communication with other people. That's the reason we get married with witnesses, right? Once you say that stuff out loud, it's a lot harder to walk away from. You're in that space and you said it, you're there. So just here's one really simple idea of how many cognitive biases have been discovered. This is from 2016. And I'll point out just an easy way to make sense of this, but each of these is an individual bias, right, that you can see. You can look this up. It's called the Cognitive Bias Codex, and you'll find this, you know, in any sort of Google search. But I point out just these four pieces here in the corner, that these are the ways to understand our biases. because we're always having to cope with a world that's got too much in it. For example, there's too much information, so some of our biases are there to help us not have to deal with everything. So biases help us sort of sort information. We also can't remember anything, remember everything. So we have some of our biases, you know, help us hang on to some things more than other things. Sometimes we just need to act, right? So we have to triage, and some of our biases help us do that, make quick choices. And sometimes there's just not enough meaning, and so we have biases that help us supply meaning that's missing. We connect dots that maybe shouldn't be connected, but at least they let us kind of move on. So one of the forces that's present is this sense of cognitive bias. Anyone in the room, any story you want to tell on yourself or you feel like that's been present for you? Steve?
Okay, so I was born in 1963, grew up in the later part of the Cold War.
I'm 2 years older than you, just for reference. Okay.
I grew up in the later part of the Cold War, and I was in the Air Force from 85 to 89, so I fought in the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And,
so to speak.
You know, during that era, communism and anything associated was the enemy, mm-hmm. which made it really hard for me to assimilate the parts of the Bible that seemed to talk about anything that might be construed as socialist.
Right.
And so after the Soviet Union fell apart and the communists weren't our enemies anymore, then I was more open to that mm-hmm. stuff.
Isn't that funny? How that works?
But I realized that so many of my peers took the other lesson. That just proves how horrible socialism is.
Right. Still a lot of folks in that space. One more.
I grew up in an upper-class Omaha family, and I noticed that people from different ethnic groups lived together. So I assumed that all the black people in Omaha lived together because they were an ethnic mm-hmm. group.
And knew each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Great example. Okay, last one.
I grew up in rural North Dakota, and I remember in high school in the 60s, early 60s, I saw the hoses by the police mm-hmm. on the demonstrators, like in
Civil
Birmingham,
Rights demonstrators, yeah.
The black kids, and that was a dissonance to me because up to that point, adults had been kind and nurturing mm-hmm. and towards kids, and I saw that and I thought, what did those kids do to
yeah.
me?
That was your first thought, right?
That was my first thought.
Yeah.
So that's how I coped with it.
Okay. All right, Kathy, last word for you.
There's a woman. Let's hear from a woman who's up on the top. Wanted to speak.
Thank you. I like this bounce. Go.
Second grade, my older sister went to France with her high school French class. She came back. She had, I believe this is where the arrow came in, she had a pin like an Eiffel Tower, and she must have told my parents it was made of wire. In second grade, my second grade teacher brought up the Eiffel Tower, and she said it was made of steel. But I knew it was made of wire because my sister had been there. And I kept whispering to everybody else, "No, it's not made of wire. It's steel."
So that's the one I think that's out there the most commonly in society. Like, why are we so bad at this? Oh, we're just all biased. Sure, we are. A second thing we do that gets studied is how we make sense of the world. We use templates. We don't start over in every new conversation. I don't look at Carol and go, oh, biped, human. So we've got these starting points in our head and we use them to make sense of things, but the templates that we try and offer aren't always the templates that we should be using in circumstances. So we have these mental schemas, we've got some people call them argument spheres that we've seen used elsewhere. So when we encounter new realities, we borrow sense-making templates rather than starting from scratch. And that doesn't always lead us in good places. Those are mental shortcuts, so they enable more detailed thought more quickly, but it's often that sort of round hole square peg kind of thing that's happening. We'll talk more about this in a little bit. A couple examples. We often rely on something called common sense. You brought up yesterday about God terms, and I was thinking about more of those. Research is one. I think common sense is another one. As an argument ender, right? Somebody says, oh, that's just common sense. You're kind of done then with the argument. How do you argue with common sense? But from supposed common sense understandings of science and its relationship to society, we have understandings that we take from those places. We just assume that's how things work. because that's how we've always assumed things were. And I'm an intercultural communication person, and I know one of the key abilities you have to communicate interculturally is the ability to interpret something ambiguous in more than one way, and to evaluate those interpretations in more than one way, positively, negatively. You run across a lot of ambiguous stuff in the world. Well, it's a key ability, but it's not intuitive for us to do that, to consider multiple interpretations, multiple evaluations. We tend to go with our first one, and then things proceed from there. So that's another example of taking these templates that we've seen before and applying them. Anyways. Any stories?
That's good.
This is maybe the hardest one to get your head around. Let's look at the third one then. So we often then, when we're judging the veracity, we're making judgments among knowledge claims that people are offering to us. There's three that we know from, you know, the ancient Greeks. We look at logic, we look at emotion, and we look at credibility, source credibility. Sometimes we'll do things just because it's the person who's telling us to do it. We don't need to know the reasoning. We don't have to feel anything about it. We just trust them. And in science communication, that's often abused. So one of the things that we do is we judge based on source credibility or emotion, often because judging based on understanding the reasoning is just too hard. So we set it aside and we head for how I feel about it, or we head for who's actually giving me the answer. So Jean Goodwin is a science communication scholar, and one of the things she's discovered in her research is that scientists reach skeptical listeners better with communication that signals their vulnerability, rather than that signals their certainty or superiority. So she's looking at that as a kind of a communication stance to take. How do you frame yourself as an expert? You might feel yourself to be an expert in that field, but what you need to moderate in the messaging is to be sure what's in there is also your vulnerability. So that speaks to the credibility piece. This here speaks more to the pathos piece. This was a US Republican presidential advisor in a previous administration. This was during the pandemic, referred to human capital stock, just as an offhand remark, talking about how they were going to deal with, you know, getting supplies where they were needed. And a lot of people stopped listening at that point to what they were actually proposing to do. And it was just a response, a physical, emotional response to the phrase of being called human capital
stock.
Stock, yeah. Stock. Right. We're having a lot of livestock metaphors applied lately to humans. But so it's an example of we stopped kind of engaging what was being offered to us because we kind of got, our feelings got caught up in something that was encoded for us, some kind of language or a feeling that drove us to a place.
So Evelyn. Human capital stock takes me back to thinking about slavery and how they thought of all those people as human capital stock.
Yep.
If they were human.
Right. So the livestock metaphor, too, came up from the Roe v. Wade overturn, is that one of the comparisons being made to help people understand the implications is the only other beings in the world to have no control over their own reproduction are livestock. And so we're equating, we're putting women in the same category legally. That's one of the metaphors that's being used that people are arguing on this piece. Go ahead.
Could you give an example of the Jean Goodwin communication that signals their vulnerability? What might that look like?
Right. It's also in standard scientific writing. I was talking yesterday when I teach students to write up their own studies, you don't say you proved anything. You really talk about, well, you know, this study adds support to. So you use more moderated language. You could say it doesn't contradict. I mean, even something that pale. You also would say something like, we're looking forward to more research in the area. I mean, just saying things like that out loud signals, this is the last word. You're not saying that. Kind of thing. By the way, I'm noticing I'm stuttering today. I stutter sometimes. I don't know why it comes on, but I know it stops when I tell you that I'm stuttering. I know. It's a weird workaround for a teacher.
I think the resistance to vaccines comes from skepticism about the government with a lot of people.
With a lot of people, yeah.
You can't trust the government. Look what they've done before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is one manifestation of this that's happening. Social media, it's really easy to program what you see, right? The algorithms are programmed to make sure you see stuff from people like you, because that's what they want, is just to get deeper and deeper into that space. And that's then, they're using that credibility of, you know, just relying on sources that you're used to seeing. And the algorithms and the people who operate them are using media tools to disorient and divide and dominate and ultimately demoralize. If you're noticing people in your life just feeling like, oh, there's so much to do. I want to get on to the next one. I'm going to be sure we have time here at the end to do the piece where you get to try these things out. I have a lot to say about these next two because these are right in the communication realm. So we're thinking beyond cognitive biases, beyond mental templates, beyond just the sorts of argument genres we pay attention to. Now we're thinking about communication as that non-neutral channel, right? It's not just a pipe. The means by which we do the communication also helps us construct shared meanings to understand phenomena, but they also can constrain and obscure what we understand. So this is a really interesting one, I think. Have you heard blueprint and recipe metaphors applied to try and help people understand what DNA is and what it does? So both of those sound like, well, that's clever, and so's that. But some folks in my discipline argue that the use of the colder and more masculinized blueprint metaphor rhetorically normalizes the genetic deselection of certain children and stigmatizes childhood disability and disease. I mean, what's a blueprint, after all, right? It's something that we are actively manipulating to design the best building possible. Recipe is a little warmer, right? You could be creative with a recipe, but you're kind of subject to your ingredients. So the argument is, if I use a blueprint metaphor, I'm kind of surreptitiously also putting forth this idea that it's okay to think about genetics in a more hands-on, manipulative way, and that's got consequences for people in the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's one. Secondly, it's really natural for us to humanize and anthropomorphize non-human phenomena. How often did we hear coronavirus depicted as an enemy that we have to fight? And that's just a given. You know, we didn't even consider whether we should be thinking of it in those terms. So that's a couple senses in which we do this. Here's some more. This is a study. How many of you remember the film The Day After Tomorrow? It's about 20 years old, and it depicted a huge, you'd know this, of course, Jen. The world ending, right? And so critics of the film were saying, oh, it's hyperbole, this is crazy. So what Ron von Berg looked at was who was most successful in communicating about that and responding to the critics of the film. And what he discovered was they were using understatement, this rhetorical device called, I think it's litotes. Anybody speak the language? Not litotes. So that they were saying things, instead of saying it's that it was false, they were saying what the film did was not untrue, and the film is, you know, not scientifically invalid. So just kind of, you know, very cleverly kind of walking the argument this way with understatement, and that actually led to greater reception of those messages just because they used that rhetorical device. Instead of having to argue that the film was true or false, they could say something kind of in the middle. Here's a couple more. One of the other ways we think about communication, it's not just about words, it's not just about nonverbal things, it's also about visual imagery. And so some folks who study science communication look at the impacts of visual images on audiences and our associations. This was a study that happened to be about nanotechnology, which is a technology so small you can't see it. So it's a really great case study for something like, I'm only going to picture it based on how it gets communicated to me. There's not a thing I can see. So they found that ancient, elegant scientific illustrations elicited the most sympathy, and that beautiful illustrations of science gave viewers pleasure. The conclusion they drew was that you got to think about the images you're using to visually define a new science. They have to be understood as drawing on everybody's kind of large pre-existing base of visual and verbal images that we associate with science. What are some of the images you associate with scientific stuff? What do you expect to see that makes you go, oh, this is probably scientific?
Graphs,
beautiful.
Diagrams with arrows.
Yeah, arrows, diagrams, boxes, circles.
I always loved those overlaying things that have different systems in the body.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah.
I think of like sepia tone maps even. Like there's something about having that sepia tone that does it for me.
I expect to see numbers.
Yeah.
Hardware.
Right. So we've got this kind of library of images in our head. So that's another kind of image. Here's another one. This is based on photography framing. Ansel Adams' photography, for example, of Yosemite, we all know it's just gorgeous, but it was kind of the paradigmatic way to photograph our national parks. And it's created, in addition to a powerful conservation movement, it's also created a false narrative that kind of fetishizes nature as idyllic and untouched and, you know, beautiful and lovely. So when you see, like, you know, a fawn getting eaten by a bear, it feels off code somehow. How did that happen? And it's largely because we associate the parks with this kind of, it's the content of the, or the form of the messaging that actually does this for us. Here's the last one. So even a communications formatted presentation style can sort of set things up that way. Remember during the COVID-19 pandemic when the Republicans were running the federal government, the press conferences were very much about, it's a show, I'm the star. And then the New York governor started having these news conference style events that were much more low key, much more information involved. There was just something about, this was a study that actually compared those two forms as being themselves either more or less persuasive. So they were looking at just the format of it. And then sometimes we just do it, pardon?
He had his mother there sometimes.
That's right. And then sometimes we do it just with graphics. This is the map that was all over the place about how red and blue we are. And then if you're not coloring all the places where no one lives red, then the map looks really different, right? How we're split politically, or at least how people declare their allegiances politically. It looks different depending on how we present it. So any stories in the room where you feel like you may have been influenced by just the form that something was communicated to you in? This is a harder one to think about. You're having to think about your thinking.
There was available.
I forgot your name.
I'm Doug.
I was going to guess Doug. I should have just guessed.
somewhat into the COVID pandemic, I discovered on the internet somewhere a movable graph that showed changes according to red state or blue state.
Right.
And as things moved around, as you got closer and closer to the present time, way more deaths were in the blue states, showing that, are we blue or red? Yeah, blue.
Red.
In the conservative states. Mm-hmm.
Those are the red states.
The red states. Way more in the conservative states. Mm-hmm.
And that affected you?
Well, it didn't affect me, but it made me think, mm-hmm. Who's surprised?
It reinforced your bias.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. It's not a bias. It's not a bias.
Okay, Steve, last word.
So, again, on the pandemic, early on, I was looking at, map of the country, and depending on whether you were looking at it in terms of absolute numbers or case rates, you get a very different picture.
Right.
And so I was looking at where I toggled between, mm-hmm. and going into case rates, it looked like there was a huge problem in North Dakota, which there was. But then you look at absolute numbers, yep. and it looks like a huge problem in New York.
Right. And we weren't consistent in how all the cases were reported, right? It was varying, and sometimes they meant one thing and sometimes they meant the other. Go ahead.
Mine is actually just about gravity from my growing up. It's like the apple falling from the tree. Gravity pulls things down.
Yeah.
And then learning about space, I'm like, well, what's down in space? Uh-huh. And then, further and further on. And, uh-huh. I mean, that's more of a case of just gravity being a really complicated thing to explain, but the same kind of thing.
Did you end up majoring in anything scientific?
No. Okay. I've thought about it.
All right. Let's go on. Here's 5 of 8. Okay, we're still sticking with how things get communicated. There's a norm in scientific communication that we're supposed to use third-person language and be really objective as we describe what we do. And yet scientists are humans. I'm deciding what to question. I'm deciding what to explore. I'm deciding what to leave out, right, by implication. So I'm always involved in the process. I'm the one collecting the data. I'm the one analyzing the data, my colleagues and I. How do we do that? So this is a force that just looks at the effect of things like even something as simple as a white lab coat. What would the effect be if I showed up here today with a white lab coat on? Would you think differently of me? Yeah. You'd have a second thought anyway. What's going on here? Yeah, what a kook. Thank you. So the symbolism of scientific objective language norms themselves can obscure important things to know about what's happening in scientific inquiry and outside of scientific inquiry too. Communication science scholars find that our science news coverage rarely contains, and people thus can misunderstand, the hedging that's built into science. This is relevant to your question earlier. It's like, how do scientists portray that sense? And you'll see later on when we talk about media reporting norms or science reporting norms that scientists used to do more of their own reporting to the public. And now it's this intermediary party and they know less about the science. So they tend to leave this out. It makes for a better story if you don't have to have those darn caveats in it. Doing so, though, leads to better understanding and reception in cancer prevention reporting in particular, is one study. And for example, right now the U.S. Republican Party has been using very sciencey language to attack trans rights nationwide, folks who identify as trans in the world, to try, and it's really to spur evangelicals to be sure they come to the vote and vote. But the sciencey language is a real tool. It makes it sounds like an objective campaign when it's an ideological campaign there. Any of you find yourself in this kind of place where you've noticed yourself being swayed by a language just sounding sciencey and objective-y? I'm going to keep using the E ending. We're nodding.
Can you give an example of the GOP sciencey language?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk right now about who should and shouldn't be permitted to do athletics, for example, mm-hmm. as part of their school experience. Mm-hmm. They use a lot of words that distinguish what makes somebody biologically male or biologically female. And as you'll see at the end of today, it's actually a much messier situation than you think it is. There's no like one biological way to distinguish men and women. And yet they use language that says it's simple, everybody. You're either this or you're that. If you're not this, you don't belong there. In fact, you're dangerous there.
Pull your pants down,
we'll
tell you.
Yeah, we will inspect you. Yeah. Well, here's six then. We're moving out from individuals to kind of more narratives. And this one I have more to say about too. It's really interesting to think about how socio-historical forces and the grand narratives that attach to them, the big stories we like to attach ourselves to, play a role. I think of like the David and Goliath story as a grand narrative. If you can tell the story of just how far behind you were before you won that race. Like you accentuate how far behind you were because that makes for a better story because it fits that narrative, you know, better. So we love these narratives and we have these ideologies that are just kind of present in our everyday thinking, our writ large, how we think about things. Things like white domination, we center our culture around making sure I feel safe and that my opportunities aren't being reduced for other folks. Colonial capitalism and American exceptionalism. America's a great country. We are the greatest country. We do everything the greatest. So these are ideologies that we have that we like. And they lead to grand narratives like the frontier. We're big on, especially when you think about science, we talk a lot about we're a country that's interested in the frontier. And in fairness and in the equal opportunity that the American dream of meritocracy supposedly provides. That all these things are really present and they generate a real headwind when we are not in those spaces. If you are offering new knowledge and you are a source that is outside that narrative or you're offering something that doesn't embrace one of these narratives or ideologies, that in itself often is a real headwind to overcome. It's very difficult for new voices in science, voices of color, trans voices in science to be heard because that's what gets focused on in those spaces. One of the characteristics that comes out of this more psychologically is that some people have kind of an identity fusion kind of radicalization, which is an interesting thing to think about, where your identity becomes tied to just one cause. And so it's, of course, the way out of that is that you help people develop more than one cause. But when you're stuck in that space, you just see everything in that lens, through that lens.
Do most people tend to fall in that category of how common is that?
How common is what?
The radicalization of just one.
I think among the fundamentalists in any movement, you'd see a lot of it. It's easy to be talked into those spaces, especially with the social media algorithms kind of increasingly trying to box us because we're easier to market in that way. So, for example, looking at what happened in the COVID-19 pandemic, there are a lot of racial disparities that we're running into communicating these findings really ran into meritocracy headwinds. They must be doing something wrong to be having these ill effects, they being people of color. In every age category, black people at the time were dying from COVID-19 at roughly the same rate as white people more than a decade older than them. That was one of the statistical truths of what was happening. Such factors spur a higher likelihood of contracting the virus, things like greater workplace exposures. We're doing the kinds of jobs we can't do from home, you know. We're riding public transport. We're living with more people, so we can't isolate privately when we're doing there. And then once you do get sick, there were poorer outcomes after acquiring COVID-19, too. So higher presence of underlying health access conditions like diabetes, hypertension, asthma, those are things that complicated your response to COVID. and receiving delayed or poorer medical care, sometimes due to distrust of medical providers or lacking health insurance. Here's another place that socio-historical stuff comes into play. One of my colleagues at the time at the University of Washington, Leah Ciccarelli, studies what she calls manufactured scientific controversies, where people use communication to create the impression that the science isn't settled, that we really are, in fact, we need to hear from both sides on the climate change debate, for example, right? Right. So she argues that those operate through clever exploitation of some of these norms and values that we have, like freedom of speech, freedom of inquiry, balancing norms, and that really the only way out that she's argued is that you have to teach people about public persuasion so they can see that stuff operating and recognize when it's actually being done with you. Last ones. Here's some more that just kind of in narratives that I think they counter. Here's Mars. I love that we have this, I don't love this, but I notice it, that there's this conversation out there like the whole planet's going to move to Mars at some point. It's not spoken, but it's like, of course we need astronauts on Mars. And, you know, the best day on Mars is going to be worse than the worst day on Earth. We've got this planet right here. You know, why aren't we focusing on that? Because Mars is the frontier. You know, we really got to get out there and do that. So it's one of the places where when you don't question this kind of thing, you recognize that's the influence of that narrative there. When we thought about how to understand obesity, for example, for a long time it was framed as a personal responsibility problem. Like, you know, what's wrong with you? Buck up, you know, work on it. And it's lately, this is 2011 now, really been framed more as more to do with emotional work than with any kind of lack of effort or merit on somebody's part. And then, of course, the famous Tuskegee syphilis study in the 1930s didn't provide treatment or explanation for its black U.S. military participants. They were just told they had bad blood. They were infected with syphilis and, you know, studied to see what the results were. And this study, Martha Solomon's pretty famous study, found the research dehumanized, of course, its participants, as did the passivity and detachment, right, that scientific language personified of the scientists, that all perpetuated an othering of the patients as simply means for doctors to achieve their scientific purpose. So we've got white supremacy in action, right? White doctors, black subjects, not even participants, just subjects, doing things that are good for somebody, and, you know, because we're a great country and we do good science, so of course we can justify this kind of thing. I'd like this. Colonial paradigms would have us believe that people were not civilized or cultured until they came across whiteness, were not educated until they came across English, French, Spanish, Dutch, are not spiritual without Christianity. Unlearn that, please. Come on. So, I mean, you maybe have seen this meme. This got out there pretty nicely, but this is sort of unpacking the bottom layer of this socio-historical moment, is we learned about Helen Keller, but we didn't really learn about W.E.B. Du Bois. And I think the we in this case is, you know, U.S. education that I got as a white guy in Minnesota. I learned about whites and Watts and the L.A. riots, but not the Tulsa or Wilmington race riots, where lots and lots of African Americans were killed by white Americans. I learned that George Washington's dentures were made of wood. I actually looked this up this morning, and it's like, yep, he had four pairs of dentures, and more than one were made from the teeth of slaves as well. So we don't learn about Black Wall Street. We don't learn about white-on-white crime. You ever heard that phrase, white-on-white crime?
Yes.
You have?
No, I've heard of it.
I've only heard black-on-black crime.
Right.
Yeah, so it's like, just think of all the things that are offered to us as things not to question in this space. And so these pieces have to do with sociohistory. This is a harder question to ask you if you've got examples where you've caught yourself thinking, oh, you know what, I think I've just behaved as though this narrative is true instead of looking at the facts that counter the narrative in this case. Any stories?
And the stuff at the bottom is going on for textbooks now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep, literally rewriting history.
Uncomfortable facts.
Yeah, there's some a Texas history textbook that was approved a few years back talked about slaves coming to the U.S. as guest workers. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, whitewashing history in that way, literally whitewashing history.
And it's terrible because so many textbooks come from Texas.
Jeff.
Yep.
When I was here in June, and you were here as well, right?
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry. The speaker was Vance Black Fox, who is a member of the Cherokee Nation and here in Holden. And so one thing I would add to that list is I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, and I learned about, we took a trip to Gettysburg as a field trip, and I learned about, those things. I never learned that Carlisle was the first Native American boarding school just, right near Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. And I didn't learn about that till I was in my 40s in seminary.
Yeah.
And so just adding to that list, we learn about the settlers and the cowboys and all that. We don't learn about the genocide mm-hmm. that was engineered into the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Great example. And this is stuff that's kind of so deeply in there, it's often hard to see it operating. We think we've got a pretty synoptic view of the world. We've actually got a pretty narrow one, at least the one we're presented. And then where do we go to expand it? One of the places we go in science is we look to science media and how media do their reporting. And the thing you know about any media is it's designed to try and hold your eye. It's designed to try and hold your interest. So many stories are not written in a way that the scientists themselves would write them. They'd actually like it to be a different way. So in the 19, this is just a brief history. As I said earlier, popular science magazines started in the 1800s, and scientists themselves were the ones often doing the writing. But then the science community started to focus more on specializing and kind of lost interest in communicating with the public in the interest of communicating with each other. So that job kind of got taken over. But by the mid-20th century, there weren't many journalists actually doing this until we got into the space race and environmental concerns. And then suddenly the media outlets felt pressure to again start reporting on science. So today the norms look like this. Science news is still pretty print-oriented, and any sort of and often focused on biomedical stuff. That's sort of the go-to for science news, is have something to do with our bodies. That has our interest. Both video science coverage still reinforces the legitimacy and sacredness of science. They just sort of present it as, well, here's what the science says, as though it's a God speaking. Science communicators, if you're doing it in this day and age, you have to be good at multimedia, right? Science communication now it's print-based, but you also have to have a visual communication that somehow represents what's going on to tap emotions and intrigue and inform. So it creates realities that are themselves compelling. Science stories can distort the science itself. We mentioned this earlier by misreporting the qualifiers and the hedging. And because of quicker turnarounds in stories, there's more pressure to publicize even less well-vetted scientific findings and consensus. Did you notice this happening during COVID?
Oh, yeah.
That they'd explicitly say, this isn't published yet, it hasn't been peer-reviewed, but we're really excited about these findings, and we're just hungry for the information. So there's a big market for stuff that's out there that hasn't actually been yet vetted by communities of its peers. And there's more outlets for that now, too. This is a big one. When journalists cover scientific topics, we tend to produce content about discrete happenings. Like, here's a silo of good new stuff. But the reporting often doesn't link the silo to the rest of the farm, and say, here's what's in the silo, and here's how what's in the silo relates to what we thought already, or what's on the neighboring farm. We're not really good at the synoptic stuff in science reporting. And these days, because everybody is both a media producer and a media consumer, science communication is starting to adopt more interactive two-way relationships with an audience. So there's a couple famous examples of studies that were essentially peer-reviewed by the public, by experts in the public who weren't part of that study's official review process. Once it got published, people weighed in on it. And the study changed as a result. Its reporting and publishing changed as a result there. I love this. This is related to the same idea. This is just a link. Here's an article called The Growing Inaccessibility of Science by Donald P. Hayes. If you'd like to read it, it costs you $9 to rent or buy it, or you could subscribe to the journal for $200. So, it's more than... It's not just science reporting. We're actually moving to our final force here in a second. Do any of you have stories where you recognize, where you feel like you have been... there's something about science reporting that you feel got under your skin?
So the company TED produces like TED Ed videos,
yeah,
which are obviously very informative, and like they're assigned as like school like, I'm assigned to watch TED Ed videos for school of, like, but it's animation, and then they're narrating it.
Yep.
And I think often you can tell the videos are produced to catch your attention, and sometimes they're confusing because of that, because they're not really giving you this, as much scientific stuff as they are trying to make it interesting so that you're still watching the video.
They don't want you to click away from it. So they're trying to hold your attention more than answer all your questions about the thing. Great example. Go ahead.
I remember all the reporting about the dot particle a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Like, what actually is that? Mm-hmm. Something quantum physics, Higgs boson, but every article was the dot particle.
There you are. I missed the yo.
Oh, sorry, yo. I think there's two. There's science journalism and the science journalists, and then there's like the editors that are writing the headlines.
Right.
And they're different. Mm-hmm. And so during COVID, I would get very frustrated with the headlines that didn't necessarily reflect the reporting or the scientific truth, but would get people to read it. Mm-hmm. And specifically the day that the COVID vaccines were, the CDC announced that they endorsed COVID vaccines for five and over, the New York Times' first push notification, as soon as that happened, the headline was something like, parents worry about safety of vaccine. And it's like, that was the fifth paragraph in the actual article. But most people aren't going to read the article, so what they got was the push notification that pulled them to be skeptical.
Right. Yep. Go ahead, window person.
Yeah. So I noticed, especially with the TV news, but also with the current or online news, that in the interest of writing a balanced story, they tend to, even though there's
like around climate?
Yeah, like especially around climate, when even, you know, maybe 1% of people who believe that climate change is not happening, but they consider it a balanced story if they give both sides of the time.
Right.
Which doesn't seem to make a lot of
sense. That's not journalism, right? It's to say, let's talk to some folks on this side, talk to some folks on that side, and just leave it out there for you to decide. If you're a journalist, you're assessing the truth claims being made by both sides, and you're making clear, you know, what's the proportion of consensus in science relative to this issue. Go ahead.
I notice that the paradigm of materialism is being challenged by some scientists, but there are many journals that won't publish anything that doesn't fit the materialist worldview. Mm-hmm.
Right. There's less of a market for it, ironically. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. The capitalist narrative we like. Doug!
I'll put in a plug for Science News, which was the first bullet on your previous screen.
Yep.
I'm a loyal reader of that, and one thing I like about it is that in the major stories, there is always something at the end that disagrees with the conclusion of the first story.
Mm-hmm.
To point out that this
fantastic.
Is not settled. And right. then they also publish readers' letters later that might bring up other issues.
So the humility question you asked earlier, what is your name?
Morgan.
Morgan. I'm Jeff.
Hi.
Hi. So it's related also, in answering your question, it's also happening contextually, right? It can happen in ways that we structure how a magazine works and how the editorial choices that folks make.
Yo.
Oh, there you are. Go ahead, Jill.
I just wanted to say, I was a journalist for 20, 25 years
yep.
ago, and the underlying model for all my stories was, it's not that simple.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are journalists out there who make it their business to make the complications, you know, to highlight those and make them understandable and all that. I mean, so there is some hope.
Yeah, you were a good journalist. So here's the last four, and then let's play with them a little bit. This last one is kind of looking at who's funding the research. Things that look like they're objectively done are often driven by agendas. I've got four examples here just to let you think about this one. There's not much more to say about it, except that there are capital-driven movements, whether they're industrial or organizational, think tank, governmental, whatever, where the money goes. And that influences which circumstances, whose experiences get inquired about. You know, whose experiences do we do science about? And then where do we disseminate? And by whom and to whom? Often it's designed to influence or muddy public policy discourse. So around climate change, there's some really interesting stuff. So for example, marketization, as you just mentioned, is really changing what the incentives are for scientists. There's some things that you're likely to get grant money for versus unlikely to get grant money for, and often they're related to market forces that you might not choose except that you need the grant money. What do you do? Climate change really became a question of belief. This is a Christian Science Monitor article that's interesting about that. And fossil fuel money, there's this kind of triumvirate of fossil fuel money, conservative Christianity, and climate change denial. That the fossil fuel industry, many of those folks were allied with, the folks who were in those industries often also were traveling in evangelical circles where they could somehow get that argument into what part of what it meant to be a faithful Christian was to be supporting industries like fossil fuel industries. So this is another really interesting piece. How did it become the word of God, climate change denial? And that the climate change denial, getting used to denying that kind of thing, has led to denial of the coronavirus pandemic as well. So there's a lot of forces that are kind of tied to who's incentivizing which research for us that's out there. And if you run across stories like this that were persuasive for you, Jim?
Jeff, maybe you received one of these too, but maybe 10 years ago, there was a widely sent out letter from the Heritage Foundation to many academics. I received one, in which they offered to pay me $10,000 in exchange for getting a paper critical of the scientific consensus and understanding of climate change in a peer-reviewed journal. They always say, oh, those climate scientists are getting rich off this climate change issue. Nope, actually the other way around.
Yeah.
It did have to be published in a peer-reviewed journal, but these days there's so many journals that sort of answer to that label that it was probably easier than... I didn't give it a try.
Why not? They probably had a couple outlets to suggest for you, or something like might get to go in. Go ahead.
I just learned that it's still true that most of the medical research dealing with how to deal with the disease has been done on male bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so
white male bodies.
Yeah, white male bodies. We know a lot less about people of color and certainly about women. So let's play with that notion. That's a nice segue, actually. Joshua, right?
Yeah.
Let's play with that notion here, and I'd love you to have a chance to reflect here. I want to introduce you to some science about gender, and I'm not really interested in your position relative to the science, but what I'd like you to reflect about is whatever your position is, how did you get there? Which of these forces do you think might have had anything to do with how you feel now as you look at some of the science about sex and gender? What do we know about those things in the world? Are there cognitive biases, sense-making templates, objective communication norms, socio-historical forces, whatever, that you can identify as maybe playing a role in your position or feeling about this, regardless of what it is? So let me show you a little information that reflects our scientific understanding here. Come on, there we go. So when you're thinking about sex and gender, this is a really great, how many of you have seen the gender-bred person before? I've seen it used as low as like high school age to understand sex and gender. But notice several things about this. We understand gender now. I understood growing up that if I wanted to be more manly, I had to become less womanly, right? They were on one line and more of one meant less of the other. We understand now that they're actually independent from each other and that you can be a lot masculine and a lot feminine or really not really either one or some mix of those pieces. Notice also there's a differentiation between the gender identity I have here and the gender expression that I offer to the world. And again, these things are also isometric. So I can think of myself in relatively manly ways, but maybe I present in more feminine ways. I find, for example, if you see me wave on this campus, I'm walking around and I see people and I always see myself doing this. Hi. So, you know, a more feminine gender expression than I actually think of myself. I think of myself as, you know, pretty on that scale there. What would that be for? We're not done, are we?
That's the start of lunch.
Oh, good. So we got time for you to think yet. Third thing is to recognize how gender and sexuality aren't the same thing. Who I'm sexually attracted to is different, right? It's not necessarily tied to my gender or gender identity. I might identify as, you know, masculine and or feminine. In my gender, and that may or may not have anything to do with who I'm sexually attracted to. And again, sexual attraction is also not on one of those scales, right? Two scales. So there are people, it's fun to ask my students, you know, well, who are you attracted to? It's like, well, I'm usually attracted to women, but I really like Billy. Yeah. So just to recognize there are these, you know, ways of thinking about what you're sexually attracted to, and then there's romantic attraction that isn't tied to what your body wants to do necessarily, but you find yourself drawn to other people. So just seeing how we understand sex and gender in these ways kind of complicates the narrative that I think that we were brought up to think about in terms of where sex and gender come from. I've got some stuff about the biology of sexes if you wanted to see it. But we don't have time today. Let me just say this, that biological sex itself even is really complex. It's more complex than XX versus XY chromosomes, even in this day and age. It's important when thinking about transgender and intersex humans. So there are two different kinds of things. Intersex humans are born biologically with characteristics of both sexes. And that sometimes emerges at birth, sometimes emerges later. But it's important to see, you know, intersex people exist, trans people exist. They are people of God. We are people of God. It's unusual, so trying to apply the usual approximations is as silly as trying to apply Newtonian physics to things moving close to or at light speed, where such physics don't apply. So here's some evidence about, in particular, trans identities, not intersex identities now, just trans identities, where folks see themselves as either in a body different than the one that was given them at birth, or they don't see themselves as fitting the binary at all. So here's a really recent study, 2021, one of the first ones of its kind. There are more than 1 million non-binary adults living in the U.S., about the size of the population of Dallas, Texas. Our census doesn't ask about this, right? It's not a category that we ask about. Among transgender kids, those who have socially transitioned, in other words, you know yourself to be different than the body you're in, and the people you live with help you do that, their gender identity is as strong as cisgender kids' identity. So children who identify as the gender matching their sex at birth tend to gravitate toward the toys, clothing, and friendships stereotypically associated with that gender. Transgender children do the same with the gender they identify as, regardless of how long they've actually lived as members of that gender. So, interesting study there. Here's one about the brain. Transgender kids' brains resemble their gender identity, not their biological sex. New study led by a Belgian neurologist, this is from 2018, found that brain activity in transgender people resembles that found in cisgender people of their gender more than their sex assigned at birth. So your brain actually resembles more who you think yourself to be, who you know yourself to be. The brain scans were compared to people of comparable age who were diagnosed with gender dysphoria. The study found that transgender boys' brains activity resembled cisgender boys, meaning I look like a boy and I think of myself as a boy, and transgender girls' brains resembled cisgender girls' brains. So even biologically, there's some root to what's here. So one little side trip here into communicating science, Celeste Condit, who's a communication scholar, argued that scientists who presume that there is a gender binary, in fact, may be forming hypotheses to reinforce a status quo misperception rather than to discover empirical truths about human sex and gendering with consequences for the scientific inquiry and the people involved. She says, brain sex research continues to expend enormous resources to report that there are a few minor differences of unknown consequence in the brains of those who are culturally sorted into the categories of female and male. This intellectually impoverished scientific practice is maintained and supported because it can be amplified in the mass media to the fact that men and women are fundamentally different, a fact that has political implications for affirmative action, the assignment of childcare duties, the prevention of women moving through the glass ceiling. Poor science is thus transformed into a set of errant public facts via an interlocking but carefully demarcated relationship between a group of scientists and a group of social gatekeepers, using rhetoric as a hidden control mechanism. Creates bad science, misrepresents empirical realities. So if you start with the presumption that men and women are different and you design a study around that, then that's what you're going to find, you know, if the question is skewed from the start. So in the Lutheran Church, we have a trans bishop at the moment.
No?
What happened to them?
It's a complicated story.
Okay, good. Tell me later.
Yep.
Let's hear from them, though. There's a really nice little, here's 3 minutes about what it's like to live in that space. Let's see if I can make this work today. And I'd invite you after this to think about those eight forces. Let's see if I can find it and then play it. Here we go. So if you've done a lot of first-hand experience of what it's like to live in that identity space, this person has something to say about it here.
I use they, their, and them as my preferred gender pronouns because I haven't really figured out how I want to have my body in the rest of my life. I'm a pastor, I'm a parent, I'm transgender, I am a work in progress.
Hey, sup? Adam and Eve, photobombing me all the time.
Growing up in South Dakota, you can imagine it's not the most fun place to figure out you're trans. The amount of religious abuse that people spoke near me and around me was enough to make me study religion.
There is no such thing as transgender. This notion that you are something other than your biology is a cultural construct intended as an assault on God.
At my college, football players would get drunk and like knock on my door in hopes of like having sex with me so that they could make me not gay anymore. People would write Bible verses from the Gospel of Matthew about how it'd be better if I had drowned in the ocean than to tell anyone else that being gay was okay. I did a lot of studying and I ended up becoming a pastor, just trying to vocalize what I knew in my gut was okay. As I became queer, I also became more faithful, which isn't the typical experience that people have. And the Lutheran Church, they declared that trans people are a beautiful part of God, and so they let me write for them and have always supported me. Being a pastor is a weird thing. Churches regularly pray for you when you have surgery, which is weird when you're having what would normally be a private part of your body removed or cared for in any sort of way. I had chronic headaches and shoulder pain. When I went to the doctor's office, I needed to have breast reduction surgery. They were like, you got two choices, Ken or Barbie. You wheel into an operating room trying to get relief, and you come out wondering how people are going to engage with your body, and it's new to you, and you don't even know how you feel about it. And the like proportioned hourglass that you used to have is now like, whoop, whoop.
Oh, great.
Oops.
I use they, their, and them as my preferred gender pronouns because I, yeah, being our feeler, I feel, used to have is now like, whoop, whoop. Most people's feelings about gay and lesbian people and trans people aren't rational. And maybe as I've matured as a pastor, I've figured out that it's feelings, right? People have a feeling or a fear that is compelling them to want to say no to an entire group of people. The way to respond to that is by being our best self and by being louder than other people's fear. I think the most important thing I can say as a queer pastor is, I'm sorry. Using faith to tear other people down is not good news. We need to all be as loud and angry as the people who want to declare that there are types of people that God can't love. People are literally dying because of it. I'm Pastor Megan. I'm 37, and I am beautiful.
Do you think you would be watching a Cosmo video? So what I want to send you away with today, invite you to just think about here. These are the biases we talked about that are present. We don't have time to do it in each other's presence here. But it's worth thinking about however you responded to just the notion of, wow, you know, sex and gender have a lot more going on than I thought they would. And I noticed myself feeling this way as I encountered this information. I'd invite you just to reflect about, you know, which of these things maybe had something to do with that. What sorts of forces maybe walked you into that feeling space and where you find yourself thinking about what's going on relative to people whose gender might be different than yours and in fact demonized by folks in the wider culture. It's a challenging thing to think about. There's also this piece here I'll leave you with since we're talking about trans folks. Trans youth who are not accepted by their family have a 41% suicidality. The number drops to 4. when they're accepted by their family, even if they're rejected by everyone else. So calling trans youth by their preferred name is suicide prevention. I just like that as a nice thing to walk away with. But to do think about these as you go on. Tomorrow we'll think about, tomorrow's session is mostly about representation in science. So we'll think about, you know, who is a scientist, whose experiences are subject to science, who's spoken to by science, and what are the implications, not just for folks who are out of that conversation, but for everybody who's in it. So very interesting, lots of video tomorrow. So if you're interested in that, do come back at the same time slot. Thanks for your attention today. Thank you.